Let's take a first look at what it says in this morning's newspapers with John S. Doyle.
The Irish Times leads with a call by the chief medical officer for people to stay at home over Easter. Dr. Tony Houlihan said last night that people with second homes should not travel to them for the bank holiday weekend. The Belfast Telegraph reports that a top Northern Ireland-born doctor, whose family ran a hotel at the Giant's Causeway, has called for roads to the seaside to be closed this Easter. "Please, please stay away," said Dr. Catherine Armstrong, who is a professor of paediatrics in Vancouver. There is no roadmap for when to ease the extraordinary restrictions imposed on the public because of the coronavirus, so says the Irish Independent in its lead story, quoting the Taoiseach. Leo Varadkar said that planning was taking place for how the restrictions on everyday life would eventually be lifted, but he admitted that the government would have to figure it out as we go along. The Irish Examiner reports that unemployment, which had been forecast to peak at 25% this summer because of the COVID-19 crisis, may have already exceeded that level 2 months earlier than forecast. €2.8 billion is the figure in the Irish Daily Mail's lead headline. That's the figure for grocery sales in the past 12 weeks. Ireland's supermarkets have had their busiest ever sales period as a result of the coronavirus outbreak, the paper says. The Star leads with the story marked exclusive under the headline Gobby Lawler. Nicola Donnelly reports that the paper has heard a recording in which Robbie Lawler, who was shot dead in Belfast at the weekend, laughed off the moment he was confronted and attacked on the streets of Dublin by what he said was a gang of kids who stole his gym bag containing his flip-flops. The news that the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been moved into an intensive care unit in London is the main story for the Irish News, the Irish Sun and the Irish Daily Mirror. In the Times, Dennis Staunton reports from London that the news about Johnson, announced last night, came as a shock in Westminster and Whitehall after Downing Street had said a few hours earlier that he was still in hospital under observation after tests. Staunton notes that Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary, is what's called the designated survivor if the Prime Minister becomes unable to carry out his duties. The coronavirus crisis has highlighted the weakness of a cabinet dominated by ideologues and placemen, but the dangerous state of the Prime Minister's health has brought it into grim, urgent focus, says Staunton. The Examiner has an interview with a housekeeping worker in Cork University Hospital. Fiona Grant has taken only one day off in the last 4 weeks. She tells Liz Dunphy, "We're extremely proud of our work. Before, frontline staff were only thought of as doctors and nurses, but we're all frontline staff. You couldn't keep CUH open without the cleaners, catering, the porters." Fintan O'Toole, in a column in The Times, writes that crisis management is what this state does best. The Irish system of governance tends to come into its own when, as Captain Boyle puts it in Juno and the Peacock, the whole world's in a terrible state of chassis, he says. But even in the immediate aftermath of the crisis, there will be profound choices, says O'Toole. One of the choices he outlines is, are we really going to declare that the one-tier health system created by COVID-19, in which people are treated according to medical need and not their ability to pay, was just a temporary little arrangement? Similarly, the Examiner in an editorial says the crisis shows that a better future is possible. It is premature to suggest that because urgent necessity finally stepped over privilege, we now have a one-tier health system, says the writer. Nevertheless, it is impossible to imagine we might return to the situation where treatment was delivered on the basis of a person's resources rather than need.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson remains in intensive care in a London hospital this morning. He was taken to hospital on Sunday evening, suffering from what were described as persistent symptoms of coronavirus. Last night, a Downing Street spokesperson said the decision to move Mr. Johnson to ICU came after his condition deteriorated. COVID-19 has hit Britain hard. The latest figures showed that at least 5,373 people have died. There have been more than 51,000 confirmed cases. Speaking last night, the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, said that Mr. Johnson had asked him to deputise where necessary.
Well, since Sunday, the Prime Minister's been under the medical care of the team at St Thomas's Hospital after he was admitted with persistent coronavirus symptoms. During the course of this afternoon, the Prime Minister's condition worsened, and on the advice of the medical team, he was moved in to a critical care unit. So in light of those circumstances, the Prime Minister asked me as First Secretary to deputise for him where necessary in driving forward the government's plans to defeat coronavirus.
Dominic Raab speaking last night. Our London correspondent Sean Whelan is on the line. Sean, what's known about Boris Johnson's condition this morning?
Not a lot this morning. There hasn't been any official updates other than to say that he is still in the intensive care unit and isn't, as far as we're aware, on a ventilating machine. Machine is available to him as a precautionary measure should he need to have it. But he was put into the intensive care unit precisely because it was reckoned that he needed a lot more care, the kind of round-the-clock care and attention that people get when they go into an intensive care unit. And as part of that, they have ventilators available to him. We also know he was given oxygen, certainly before he was moved into the intensive care unit. But we don't know whether he's still been given oxygen whilst there. But it's certainly he would have an oxygen supply immediately available to him again, should he need it, should his condition require that.
Listening to the news from London yesterday, there was a growing sense that journalists were sceptical about the official lines coming from Downing Street. And as it turned out, they were right to be sceptical.
Yeah, and they were sceptical for a couple of reasons. First, there was the sort of growing whispers around Downing Street over the long weekend period, if you like. Remember, Boris Johnson had gone into isolation last Friday week. So last Friday, he should have been coming out of isolation if, according to the government's own guidelines, everything had gone well, that he'd had, as was being put about, a mild case, mild symptoms of the coronavirus. He should have been back at work on Friday. Matt Hancock, the health secretary, emerged on Thursday looking fairly chipper, a day early, really, but nevertheless back at work. And we've seen Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, the man who advised Boris Johnson to get himself tested. He also appeared back at work on Monday in his role as England's chief medical officer. But there was no sign of the Prime Minister. And rumours were circulating that actually it was a bit worse than they were letting on. Then the video emerged on the Friday evening. People said, gosh, look at Boris, not looking great, is he? And it went on from there. And the next thing you know, on Sunday, he's being admitted into hospital. And the phrase that was used was as a precaution, just in case. But then that phrase cropped up again last night when he was admitted into the intensive care unit. He's only moving as a precaution. So again, people were saying, hang on, these guys are holding back something here. Secondly, this government has been caught out a number of times exaggerating or spinning about elements of the management of the coronavirus, notably on things like the number of ventilators, in particular the number of tests that were being carried out for the disease, the type of testing kits that were available, exaggerations around the availability of an antibody test, which was comprehensively trashed by their scientific advisors yesterday. So they've been victims of their own propaganda to an extent of always presenting a sunny side up picture a number of times throughout this crisis. And now in relation to the Prime Minister's health, people were just sceptical.
So Dominic Raab is now in charge, and he's in charge at a very, very difficult time.
It's an extremely difficult time for all governments. I mean, all governments that are confronting this crisis all around the world, it's extremely difficult. Being a prime minister or a government leader is a difficult job anyway. It's a job that is very physically demanding. You can see it visibly aging people. I mean, you look at the pictures of Barack Obama before and after being president of the United States, or Tony Blair. This job really takes it out of people. And that's in the normal times. This is not a normal time. This is a time of extreme crisis. And ministers are making life and death decisions almost all of the time. Pretty much every decision that is being made in governments around the world involves a trade-off with loss of life. And that sort of thing weighs heavily on people. Boris Johnson himself, a pretty robust kind of an individual, doesn't believe in getting sick, thinks it's a bit of a character weakness in people, likes to battle on, and that's probably counted against him because at a time when he should have been resting, he has been working. And right up until yesterday afternoon, around 5 o'clock, the official line was, yes, the Prime Minister is getting his big red boxes and working through them and is in contact with all the ministers. But the very minister who was saying that, Dominic Raab, the designated person to take over from the Prime Minister, was forced to admit under questioning from journalists that, in fact, he hadn't spoken to the Prime Minister for 2 days. And a couple of hours later, he's on television saying, yes, I'm basically in charge now, but looking like the rabbit who'd been caught in the headlamps, really didn't look convinced or convincing, and looked rather shocked that he was now on the spot. He is going to chair this cabinet subcommittee this morning that deals with the coronavirus, the 9-15 war cabinet, as it's known. But the regular Tuesday morning cabinet, that was scrapped yesterday. That was one of the first things that was decided at that 9 a.m., 9:15 meeting yesterday morning under Mr. Raab's leadership. So it's just purely focus now is all on managing the coronavirus outbreak. Mm. But sooner or later, and we think maybe next Monday or Tuesday, they're supposed to have a review of the whole lockdown process. That's the first big decision that's going to be faced by this cabinet that'll be chaired, presumably still at that point, by Dominic Raab.
All right. Sean, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Sean Whelan in London.
The wave of infection here from COVID-19 is being pushed down, and the peak could be lower and further away than expected, according to the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan. With a further 370 cases of coronavirus confirmed yesterday, bringing the total here to 5,364, Dr. Houlihan urged people to continue social distancing, and in particular to stay home for Easter. Speaking later on the Clareburn Live programme, Dr. Colm Henry, the HSE's chief clinical officer, said it was too early to know if the rate of infection here was within the capacity of the hospital system to cope.
There have been some positive trends emerging the past few days. It is too early to say if those trends will pay the dividends we want them to say. That is to say, stem the growth of this virus so much that our hospital system and our healthcare system will be able to withstand. It's too early to say. We have definitely bent the curve. We need to bend it more.
Let's talk to our health correspondent, Fergal Barrs. Good morning, Fergal. First of all, perhaps you might bring us up to date with the latest information to emerge from yesterday evening's briefing and some further information that you have acquired from internal documents in relation to all of this.
Well, the latest figures show that coronavirus cases, they are growing at an unsustainable rate, and it is greater than the capacity of the health system to deal with it if it keeps going this way. So the numbers need to reduce. Now, we have seen 169 patients admitted to intensive care units. So those figures were issued last night. But the number of people in intensive care, it's not growing at the rate we saw in the early days of the outbreak. So, I mean, there are positive elements to that. But obviously, for each individual in intensive care, it's an incredibly challenging, serious and uncertain time. So we're aware of that. Also, 33 people have recovered from intensive care. So that's also good news. In relation to the latest cases, well, we see 1,263 involve healthcare staff. So that really does remain a particular concern. Now, new figures which we've seen show that Beaumont Hospital in Dublin has the largest number of confirmed cases of COVID-19. It has 133 cases. That's as of 2 o'clock yesterday. And it's followed by St. James's with 95 and the Mater with 87. And then outside of Dublin, Cavan has 34 confirmed cases in the hospital. Limerick has 33. These figures are contained in an internal operational document issued by the HSE to key staff, which has been seen by RTE News. And that shows us that nationally, there are 829 patients in hospitals with confirmed COVID-19 cases.
Talk to us about this very specific appeal that Dr. Houlihan made yesterday evening for people to stay at home this Easter. There's some concern, is there, that the holiday weekend, and particularly if the weather's good, could prompt people to head out and leave their homes and perhaps increase the risk of spreading the virus.
Yes, I mean, there's a couple of elements to that. The weather is improving, people can see it, and temperatures are rising. And we are heading into the Easter bank holiday weekend when traditionally people would travel. And I mean, we hear of cases where people are possibly planning to travel to second homes. So I asked him about this at yesterday's briefing, and his advice really is for people to stick to the rules that are in place, that they remain at home, that they don't travel, that they have patience, because this is important. There's also the issue that the Gardaí currently, it appears, don't have the powers in place to implement those rules, and that it's highly possible that people would seek to travel around the country, across the country, down the country, if the weather is very, very good, with a bank holiday weekend. So there's a danger there that some of the gains that have been achieved could be lost if large numbers of people were to travel in good weather.
Well, now, the National Public Health Emergency Team, which I think Dr. Houlihan chairs, it's meeting today, and to meet, it'll meet again on Friday to consider various matters. Let's just talk about one or two of them. First of all, this question of providing childcare for health workers. There was a promise some weeks ago that the government would move on this. The Taoiseach says it is ready. He is ready to go. They are ready to push the button, as it were, but they're waiting for clearance from NPHET. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, this was mooted about 3 or 4 weeks ago, actually, but it's not in place yet. And we've heard some nurses talking about the fact that they're facing bills of, say, about €110 a day for child mining. So it is a difficulty. Now, the government has indicated that there is funding available. It wants public health clearance from the National Public Health Emergency Team on it. So the National Public Health Emergency Team will meet this morning, and it'll discuss a number of issues, including this. People might ask, well, why is the Public Health Emergency Team getting involved in this? But there'd have to be safety issues to be dealt with here. Mm-hmm. If, for example, a large group of children relating to healthcare staff were being minded in the same area, you'd have to make sure that that's safe, because 1,263 cases of COVID-19 involve healthcare staff. So there are measures that would have to be recommended. So we'd be looking to the Public Health Emergency Team to come up with recommendations there, and it'll advise government.
And just very quickly, Fergal, I don't know if there is any further information on this, but the commitment that was made to try and provide accommodation for healthcare workers, perhaps who are living in more crowded conditions, so that too could reduce the risk of infection between health workers, who still remain a very high proportion of those who contract the virus.
I think that's been built on. I mean, a lot of these measures we hear about, they take time to put in place. I mean, the suggestion was there are such a large number of hotel rooms available around the country that those could be utilised, where staff wouldn't be forced to break their current accommodation, but those could be utilised to help them. Some of the figures that are in that report I was talking about earlier that we've seen are quite positive. So the day-on-day percentage increase in cases is really interesting. I was looking at that a short time ago. So yesterday, the day-on-day increase on the previous day of cases was up 8.5%. But if you look at in early March, we were seeing percentage day-on-day increases, in some cases of 62%, March the 12th for that number. So there are positives here, but it's still very, very early days. And we haven't started at all, really, to start to move up towards the peak of this outbreak.
So when NPHET meets, as I say, this week, it will also presumably consider the current restrictions. They are due to expire at the weekend. It'll be offering further advice to the government on presumably continuing those and perhaps bringing in further restrictions, or maybe relaxing some at some point.
Well, Dr. Tony Houlihan did say, you know, that on Friday then the National Public Health Emergency Team will meet. But at this point, he's not expecting any significant lifting or changes. There may be some relaxation in some areas, but it sounds to me that that's quite modest. And I think if anyone is expecting that from Easter Sunday, when the current measures, you know, expire, as it were, that somehow they'll be lifted, that clearly isn't going to happen. I think you'd have to think that we have many, many more weeks in place of the measures, and they'll be kept in place for as long as they have to be and no longer. And that's to quote Dr. Tony Houlihan last night, but they won't be lifted any earlier, given the dangers in lifting restrictions and what could happen.
Very good, Fergal Paris. Thank you very much indeed for that.
First look at the business headlines. Next, we're joined this morning by Petula Martin. Good morning, Petula.
Good morning, Rachel. Stena Line will furlough 600 employees and make 150 redundant across Ireland and the UK as a result of the impact of the coronavirus on the volume of traffic on its routes. In a statement, the firm said it was forced to take tough decisions in order to cut costs and ensure that their supply lines of essential goods to Ireland and the UK are protected. More than 100 global organisations are calling for debt payments of developing countries to be dropped this year. The group says resources must be directed towards the needs of populations and not diverted to lenders. Parcel delivery company DPD Ireland has seen a big increase in online deliveries. There's been a 200% increase in deliveries of electrical goods, a 100% increase in food and pet accessories, and an 85% increase in deliveries of sports equipment. More on that before 8. Taking a look at the currencies, 1 euro buys 88.2 pence sterling and 1 US dollar 8 cents.
4 years after his first bid for power, Alan Kelly became the Labour Party's new leader on Friday evening. Although Labour has said it wants to remain in opposition, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are still eyeing it up as a potential coalition partner. This means that within days of gaining power, Mr Kelly is already facing his first real leadership test. We'll be speaking to him later in the programme, but first, our reporter Fiacra O'Kiani reports on the options facing the party.
Four years after his first bid for power, Alan Kelly is now officially the flag bearer of the Labour Party. The Tipperary TD replaced Brendan Howland on Friday, beating fellow contender Eoin Reardon. But now he is in power, he faces a new challenge, national interest versus party interest, a situation he outlined on Saturday to RTE News.
We'll do whatever is in the national interest. But as regards the government, I believe a majority government is needed for a number of years from the parties that I've just stated. But of course, we will talk to anybody if they approach us.
For now, Labour's official plan is to remain in opposition and allow rivals to form a government. But its new leader has not entirely ruled out at least speaking with Leo Varadkar and Micheál Martin if they make an approach. A scenario Fia Kelly, Irish Times deputy political editor, says is likely in the coming days.
Well, this week, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are expected to agree a framework document that they will then bring to the Labour Party, the Social Democrats, the Greens. The Greens have backed away. The Social Democrats are quite clear that they don't see their policies as compatible. So consequently, attention has turned to Labour. I expect that the old big two parties are not the only big two anymore. We'll be putting pressure on Alan Kelly in the weeks ahead.
The suggestion pressure may come on Alan Kelly is already apparent by the fact Labour TDs and councillors declined to give their views on the record so as not to block off any position options for their leader in future talks. But the party's older generation is more open about speaking. Last week, former Labour President Pruntius de Rossa wrote to party members urging them to push for Labour to go into government. And while not going as far, former Labour leader Pat Rabbit told his programme Mr Kelly will have to make sure whatever decision he takes is supported by the wider party.
Well, I think after this emergency is over, that a great majority of people will want to see a stable government. In those circumstances, I think Labour would be minded to put its shoulder to the wheel, but I don't see the new leader, Alan Kelly, taking any decisions where he's not confident that the party is majorly behind him.
Elaine Byrne, political commentator and Business Post columnist, is of a similar view, saying Labour ultimately has two choices, both of which offer opportunities and pitfalls.
They're in or they're out. There are a number of issues between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil that you would assume fall into the lap of Labour policies, particularly that of housing, social partnership, the pension age. So these are issues that Labour would wish to see emphasised in any new government.
Ultimately, it is the choice of power in government or growth in opposition that will dominate Alan Kelly's first days as Labour leader. A confidence and supply style deal may also be placed on the negotiation table and, says Fia Kelly, this third option could be where Labour eventually lands, both to the benefit of the party and its newly elected leader.
The position of the party has been that it wants to head to opposition, but there have been suggestions that it could facilitate the election of a government. Could the Labour Party allow a Taoiseach from a Fianna Fáil Fine Gael government to be elected and then offer some sort of confidence supply type agreement helping the country through the coronavirus crisis? As one TD said to me last week around the party, does a new leader want in his first act to create a divisive debate within the party and create acrimony? That is something that if the Labour Party were to think about going into government, that Alan Kelly would have to consider.
And that was Fia Kelly ending that report from Fiacra O'Kiani. We'll be talking to Alan Kelly later on in the programme.
Next to the United States, where the coronavirus death toll is creeping towards 5,000 in America's worst hit state, New York. There have been more than 131,000 cases, although New York's governor said yesterday that the daily death total has been effectively flat for 2 days. But New York remains quieter than normal, much quieter, and just like here, people are worried about their health, their livelihoods, and the future of their communities. Cian McCormack joins us with more on this. Cian, you've been talking to some Irish people in the city of New York.
Yes, Brian, starting with Sinead Naughton, originally from New Inn in County Galway. She's been living in New York for 25 years and she has two restaurant bars in the heart of the city, both premises closed on March 16th. She's concerned for her workers, her customers and her business because, as she says, nobody knows how or when this will end.
As time goes on, it's like, oh my God, like we've let go of our staff. We don't know when we're going to reopen. You know, it's a very, very, very strange time in New York at the minute.
When you say it's a strange time, what do you mean?
For example, the bars never close. So we are, you know, bars are open until 4 o'clock in the morning. We open again at 11 o'clock in the morning. We have porters and cleaners that come in at 4 and they're there until 11. So there aren't even good locks on the doors. You know, they're never empty. So even just walking through an empty bar in the heart of New York City is very, very strange. Now, we had to board up one of the bars because of an attempted break-in. And I hope that that is not a general experience in the city. We haven't heard of a lot of break-ins yet, but a lot of people are boarding up their businesses. It's a very, very strange and somewhat heartbreaking time. It's hard to take in. You know, I think as of this morning, we had something like we were close to 5,000 deaths in New York City alone. I think about our regulars. It's awful to get this personal, but like I think about the people who may not be there when we go back, and that sounds so utterly depressing. But we don't know where this will go. I know I shouldn't delve to that level of thought, but, you know, if the death toll continues to rise and you watch the news and you hear words like death and great sadness and all of these things, like, this is not a disease that discriminates, as we all know. We don't know who is going to be there. We don't know if I'm going to be there. We don't know how this is going to finish or when.
Sinead Naughton there. She's now in New Jersey where she lives and she says locals there have a growing concern about the virus spreading, Brian.
You also spoke to two people living in New York, Ian, and the way they're approaching what's happening in the city.
Yeah, that's right. They seem to be approaching it much along the same lines as we are here. Social distancing is key, but this city, it's not like it is usually. Yesterday, I contacted Michelle C. Ganovich, originally Kavanagh from Dunboyne in County Meath, who's on maternity leave from her job as a fashion designer. She's living with her four-month-old daughter and her husband near Central Park.
Well, I work for a fashion company. I'm currently on maternity leave and my company have made all of their employees, they put them on furlough, which basically means that, you know, their jobs will be there for them once, you know, everything settles down after COVID-19 and the pandemic. So hopefully things will pick up soon and we'll all be back to work. Today in New York, the city is extremely quiet. It feels very odd. Well, we live on 103rd in Central Park West, and there's the 103rd subway station, which I can see right outside my window, and there's just no one coming in and out of it. It's very bizarre. There's no rush hour traffic. You see the odd person going in and out, which would be, I would presume, our essential workers. that would be on the front line.
You mentioned the front line. When you go for a walk, you see it. Can you explain that to me?
Yes. So our front door leads onto Central Park West. So we are right on Central Park. And we, on our daily walk, we can see the field hospital that is right in front of Mount Sinai. I believe they're taking overflow patients from the hospital, treating people with COVID-19. So it's a very sad sight to see in New York. And usually those tents, when you see a tent in New York, there's either a festival on or a fair or just something more positive.
The response in the United States, what's your view on it?
I think it's been really good response by government, especially local government. Governor Cuomo, he talks usually every morning on the main news channels here, and he's got quite a calming presence about him, and he's really reassuring and being very informative.
Michelle C. Ganovich there. Also in New York for the past 18 years is Gavin Manley from Dublin. He works in branding, advertising and marketing. He says the city needs to dig deep.
We were here, I missed 9/11, but was here for the big blackout that we had. I think it was in 2003 or 2004. And then we had obviously Hurricane Katrina 8 years ago almost now. So we kind of lived through those kind of crazy times in the city. So this just feels like another one that is, you know, another time to kind of dig deep. And obviously we don't know how this is going to end or when it's going to end. But yeah.
What's the atmosphere like in the city?
I think now it's a little less, it's sort of, we've adopted a sort of a new normalcy attitude to things a little bit. What we're also hearing on the news nationally is that this week is going to be, you know, what I think Trump said was a lot of death this week coming our way. So, I mean, everyone is still on edge. You go into the grocery store and people, you can feel the tension, people kind of not wanting to stand next to one another. We're spaced out, you know, I think much like it is in Dublin, 6 feet or 2 meters apart or whatever it is. And there's sort of an anxiety that you can feel sometimes bubbling over as well.
And that's Gavin Manley talking to Cian McCormick from New York there. Cian, thank you for that. Astronomers are promising us a treat in the night sky tonight, a pink supermoon, the first full moon of spring, coinciding with the moment when in the lunar cycle when the moon is closest to Earth. And the good news is that even if it's a bit cloudy tonight, there's still a good chance of seeing the spectacle, as it'll last the entire night. Francis McCarthy is Education and Research Officer at Black Rock Observatory in Cork and can tell us more. A very good morning to you, Francis.
Good morning to you, Brian.
So tell us about this pink supermoon. What are we going to see?
Okay, so first off, the name pink is not what we're looking for in color. The names that we have for the full moons have very much come to us from North American culture, and the old farmers' almanacs would assign a name of what was ever happening in the world at the time. So if you're in North America right now, there's a beautiful flower that blooms at this time of year, and it's a pink color. So the pink moon is the color of the ground. What we're going to be looking for is a full moon. It'll be full in the very middle of the night. So the moon that we look for to be rising at sort of about 7:30-ish. Okay, so opposite the sunset. So figure out where the sun's going down. Right now I'm looking out east. I can see a beautiful sunrise just coming up over Cork Harbor. And I'm going to be looking east tonight for moonrise. The sun will be behind me, setting over in the west. So a roughly 7:30-ish, we're looking for the moon to come up. And that's at the time that the moon will, in fact, be the very closest to us. So it'll be quite close to us in the sky, in actual terms. You want the numbers? Less than 357,000 kilometers.
Right, that close.
Yeah, so that's really close. Got to remember, people look at the moon and go, wow, it's really close, which compared to any other, you know, celestial object, it is. But it still took the astronauts 3 days to get there. It's a pretty far distance away.
But the spectacle is going to last through the night. I mean, it's at its closest as we see it initially in the east, but it'll actually be evident right through the night. Is that the case?
Yes, so the moon will be rising, and then it will be at its, you know, high in the sky, and close to us, the time of the actual full moon will be in the middle of the night. So it'll have moved, a couple of hundred kilometres away by that point, but it will still be spectacularly bright. Mm. It's about 10% bigger. Now, it is very tricky to notice that 10%. If you go, the moon that I saw rising last night and the moon that I see rising tonight, well, when they're right near the horizon, they look enormous anyways. There's a secondary effect that happens that's not completely understood, but when you look at the moon rising right on the horizon, you would swear it has swollen up to 20 times its normal size. Have you ever noticed that? You just catch the moon and you go, whoa!
Yes, and it just takes your breath away
for that moment.
Does. Now, and as you say, this is a phenomenon.
It's a slightly ridiculous trick to try shrink it back to its normal size. And I like to describe it as trying to catch the moon in your hands. So grab your hands and just kind of squeeze around the moon and just squeeze and squeeze and squeeze and see just how big it is when you're not referencing it to the horizon. And it's really remarkable.
All right. And as we're all stuck at home at the moment, it's something that might pass a little bit of time tonight. Just a final question, Francis, and I didn't know this, but we always have a full moon in the week before Easter, because, of course, Easter is determined by the lunar cycle and the sequence of full moons over the spring period.
It is. So I always know that Easter week, even if I'm not entirely sure when the full moon is, I know that I get a full moon the week immediately before Easter. So I love looking out for that and thinking, you know, will the weather be with us? And I think today is going to be glorious.
Yeah, yeah.
So the thought of just, you know, 7:30 tonight, moseying out under the setting sun with the moon rising, could there be anything better?
I can't think of anything. Francis, thanks very much indeed. We will look forward to that. Appreciate you talking to us this morning.
Good morning, Brian. Parcel delivery company DPD Ireland has seen a big increase in online deliveries. Up to last Friday, the company was seeing a 200% increase in deliveries of electrical goods, with deliveries of food and pet accessories up by 100%. Des Travers is chief executive of DPD Ireland. Des, you and your staff have been very busy, and it's thanks to online shopping.
Yes, for sure there is indeed, and there's been a significant shift now in, I suppose, everybody's business in Ireland. It's now all B2C to home delivery, and we are now delivering the things that people want in their homes at this difficult time.
And are you seeing an increase, are businesses who used to have stores open, are you seeing them moving to online presence and you're delivering their goods now?
Yes, it's a mixture of customers who would have had their stores open and have now moved to their online presence for all revenue, and we're now the lifeline for that company's revenue. And in particular, as I say, we are seeing things like electronics, where people are at home and they want a new set of earphones, or they want a new iPad or iPod or whatever they want. We've seen a lot of that type of equipment go through our network at the moment, and also then other things that are nearly more essential, like food and also pet food for their animals. So there's a whole mix of goods going through us at the moment.
And you have changed how you deliver. The recipient does not have to sign for their parcel anymore.
Yeah, we've had to take a whole load of COVID-19 precautions. You know, the safety of our staff and our drivers is particularly important to us. And we've provided all our staff with the masks, the gloves and the sanitizers. We do a final mile with no signature now, so the driver goes up to the doorstep, he rings the doorbell, he leaves the parcel on the door or puts it through the letterbox, and when the person comes out, he's at least 2 metres away, and then we get the name and we put the name on the signature for the POD. So we are completely social distant, all our team, and we've done the same with our hub teams and our network teams to enable us to be able to continue to operate in this environment.
While you've seen an increase in online deliveries, you don't expect it to last. Why not?
Well, to be honest, when I put out my note on this, I didn't expect it to last, but it has. The last 2 days have been extremely strong in our network, and we expected to see a slowdown with a lot more people, 750,000 people now being on the social register, and we think that the people will tighten up their spend, and it may well drive down the number of parcels that are coming through the network, but we haven't quite seen it yet, although we expected to see it at this point.
Okay, but DPD Ireland is operating as normal. For now, Des Travers, Chief Executive of DPD Ireland, thank you for joining us this morning. I'll have more business news at 8:30. For now, back to you, Rachel.
Well, we heard a few minutes ago that it was a lovely morning in Cork. It's also beautiful and clear here in Dublin. For the weather outlook, we can go next to Met Aaron and Jerry Murphy.
Thank you very much indeed, Rachel, and a very good morning from Met Aaron on what is a lovely morning right across the country. Now, in general, for the rest of the week, our weather will be noticeably milder than recently, with temperatures getting up as high as 17 or 18 degrees in places tomorrow and Thursday. It will be dry between now and Thursday evening, but we will see rain or showers on Friday and over the weekend. So for this morning, bright and clear over much of the country, a few patches of mist and indeed a touch of frost in one or two parts of the Midlands, but these would soon burn off, and today is going to be a dry and bright day right across the country with good spells of sunshine. And highest temperatures will range from about 11 degrees along the west coast to 14 or 15 degrees in the east, with the best values in North Leinster. We will see moderate to fresh southerly breezes. And then tonight, for that moon rising, clear conditions early in the night. However, and indeed staying clear over much of the country, and again quite cold with temperatures between 0 and 3 degrees, but becoming cloudier in parts of Connacht and Ulster, and we will see some patchy rain or drizzle developing in the northwest overnight. Then tomorrow will continue quite cloudy in the northwest with some patchy drizzle, but for much of the country, another bright day with good sunshine developing and temperatures getting up as high as 14 to 18 degrees in parts of the Midlands, east and south. And then beyond that, then Thursday will continue mild and quite warm, sunny spells again. Again, with some the best of the temperatures between 14 and 18 degrees. However, on Thursday evening, we will see some rain developing in the southwest, and that will push up over the country on Thursday night. And then we see a change on Friday, a wetter day on Friday in many areas, and temperatures dropping back that bit. And we see some further rain or showers at times over the weekend as well. But in the meantime, for today, a very pleasant, warm day with good sunshine in all areas and temperatures between 11 and 15 degrees. That's the forecast. Good morning.
Good morning again. You're listening to Morning Ireland with Brian Dobson and Rachel English. With the news in detail, here's Brian Jennings.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who's ill with COVID-19, has spent the night in an intensive care unit in a London hospital after his symptoms worsened yesterday. He was moved to the unit last night as a precaution and is not on a ventilator, according to Downing Street. Our London correspondent, Sean Whelan.
At a time of great emergency, the head of the British government lies in an intensive care unit, a victim of the virus his government, like all others, is fighting. Boris Johnson was admitted to St Thomas's Hospital in London on Sunday evening as a precaution. 23 hours later, he was moved to the hospital's intensive care unit, again as a precaution, according to Downing Street, after his condition worsened over the course of the afternoon. His spokesman said the Prime Minister remains conscious and was not on a mechanical ventilator, although one is available to him if he needs it. It's reported he had received oxygen before moving to the ICU. The Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, is deputising for the Prime Minister in his absence. He'll once again chair the COVID-19 Cabinet Subcommittee later this morning, but has postponed the regular Tuesday meeting of the full Cabinet. Sean Whelan, RTE News, London.
The National Public Health Emergency Team will meet today to discuss the current approach to dealing with coronavirus here. It is also due to consider how childcare supports can be provided safely for healthcare staff. The latest official figures show that 16 more people have died, bringing the total number of deaths here to 174. A further 370 cases of the virus were confirmed, taking the total to 5,364. Our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
The latest figures here show that cases of COVID-19 are growing at an unsustainable rate, greater than the capacity of the health system to cope if the current trend continues. New figures seen by RTE News have revealed that Beaumont Hospital in Dublin has the largest number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 with 133 patients. It's followed by St James's, which has 95 cases, and the Mater Hospital with 87. Both hospitals also in Dublin. Outside of the capital, Cavan General is caring for 34 cases and Limerick University Hospital has 33. The figures are contained in an internal HSE report for key staff. It reveals that nationally, there are 473 suspected cases of COVID-19 in hospitals awaiting test results, with the largest number at Talla Hospital, where there are 23 such patients. The report shows there are 2,450 vacant general beds in public hospitals and 130 vacant critical care beds. Meanwhile, the National Public Health Emergency Team will meet today to discuss the current approach to dealing with coronavirus here. It's also due to consider how childcare supports can be provided safely for healthcare staff and will advise the government on this.
Australian Cardinal George Pell has been freed from prison after winning a long-running battle to overturn child sex abuse convictions. The 78-year-old former Vatican treasurer was acquitted in Australia's High Court on all five counts of sexually abusing two 13-year-old choir boys in the 1990s. He had steadfastly maintained his innocence. The drafting of a framework document being worked on by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael will continue today. The document, which could provide a pathway to the formation of the next government, is expected to be signed off when the parties meet again in the coming days. Our political correspondent, Micheál Lehan.
It's expected the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael leaders will present this agreed text to the leaders of smaller parties, and this could possibly happen even before the end of the week. They will hope to entice them to join a government that will have to deal with the fallout from the COVID-19 crisis and plan for the societal and economic recovery afterwards. It's understood that increased state intervention in health, housing and childcare will form the key part of the effort to entice other parties to join Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in forming the next government. It is unlikely to be laden with figures and exact targets, given the volatility sparked by the coronavirus. Instead, it will contain principles that can be added to by other parties and independents who agree to form a coalition. The Fine Gael leader said yesterday that small parties would have to have their core agenda included in any programme for government.
Eurozone finance ministers are expected to agree to use Europe's bailout fund to help support economies stricken by the coronavirus pandemic. However, during a video conference this afternoon, they are expected to stop short of agreeing to pool European debt through so-called corona bonds. A new survey indicates that the vast majority of Irish adults expect the economy to be in worse shape next year as a result of the coronavirus, with almost a third of people worried about their job security. The survey on Irish perspectives and experience of COVID-19 was commissioned by Behaviour and Attitudes and produced for RTE. Mary Regan reports.
This survey is a snapshot of how Irish people are dealing with the coronavirus crisis, and the overall picture is of a population that's extremely worried, but with a sense that things are under control. 1,016 adults were interviewed between March 27th and April 1st, meaning the survey had just begun when the current restrictions were announced. It found that 97% of people are worried to some extent. Two-thirds of those over the age of 65 are extremely concerned about contracting the virus. For many young people, this is their first crisis, and more than a third of those under 25 are very anxious that this is making them unhappy, compared to just 9% for those over 65. People are largely abiding by public health advice. A fifth of Irish people are now working from home. Television is by far the most popular source of information on the virus, with 85% saying they're keeping informed by watching TV. Overall, people are happy with how it's being handled. 4 out of 5 believe the government is doing a good job, while the majority say they're proud of how Ireland is responding as a country, particularly the healthcare professionals.
Now the time is coming up to 8:30 past 8.
RTE Radio 1 weather with SuperValu. As we all continue to lay low, rest assured we're working day and night to keep our stores stocked and our communities served.
Cold early this morning with frost in places and some patches of mist. Dry and bright during the day with good sunny spells in all areas. Highest temperatures 11 to 15 degrees. Coolest along the west coast and warmest in North Leinster.
The Irish Times leads with a call by the chief medical officer for people to stay at home over Easter. Dr. Tony Houlihan said that people with second homes should not travel to them for the bank holiday weekend. The Belfast Telegraph reports that a top Northern Ireland-born doctor whose family ran a hotel at the Giant's Causeway has called for roads to the seaside to be closed this Easter. "Please, please stay away," said Dr. Catherine Armstrong, who is a professor of paediatrics in Vancouver. There is no roadmap for when to ease the extraordinary restrictions imposed on the public because of the coronavirus, so says the Irish Independent in its lead story, quoting the Taoiseach. Leo Varadkar said that planning was taking place for how the restrictions on everyday life would eventually be lifted, but he admitted that the government would have to figure it out as we go along. The Irish Examiner reports that unemployment, which had been forecast to peak at 25% this summer because of the COVID-19 crisis, may have already exceeded that level 2 months earlier than forecast. 2.8 billion euro is the figure in the Irish Daily Mail's lead headline. That's the figure for grocery sales in the past 12 weeks. Ireland's supermarkets have had their busiest ever sales period as a result of the coronavirus outbreak, the paper says. The Star leads with a story marked exclusive under the headline Gobby Lawler. Nicola Donnelly reports that the paper has heard a recording in which Robbie Lawler, who was shot dead in Belfast at the weekend, laughed off the moment he was confronted and attacked on the streets of Dublin by what he said was a gang of kids who stole his gym bag containing his flip-flops. In The Independent, Ken Foy reports that criminals linked to the Maguire side of the Drogheda gang feud are now the chief suspects for the killing of Robbie Lawler. He says Gardaí have seized what they believe was a bounty of €50,000 paid for the killing. The Irish News, the Irish Sun and the Irish Daily Mirror all lead with the news that the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who has been treated for COVID-19, has been moved into an intensive care unit at a London hospital. In The Times, Dennis Staunton reports from London that the news about Johnson, announced last night, came as a shock in Westminster and Whitehall after Downing Street had said a few hours earlier that he was still in hospital under observation after tests. The Examiner has an interview with a housekeeping worker in Cork University Hospital. Fiona Grant has taken only one day off in the last 4 weeks. She tells Liz Dunphy, "We're extremely proud of our work. Before, frontline staff were only thought of as doctors and nurses, but we're all frontline staff. You couldn't keep CUH open without the cleaners, catering, the porters." Fintan O'Toole, in a column in The Times, writes that crisis management is what this state does best. The state, mostly so sluggish during the lifetime of the outgoing government, has switched itself on with remarkable alacrity, he says. But after the crisis, there will be profound choices, says O'Toole. One of the choices he outlines is, are we really going to declare that the one-tier health system created by COVID-19, in which people are treated according to medical need and not their ability to pay, was just a temporary little arrangement? Similarly, the Examiner, in an editorial, says the crisis shows that a better future is possible. It is premature to suggest that because urgent necessity finally stepped over privilege, we now have a one-tier health system, says the writer. Nevertheless, it is impossible to imagine we might return to the situation where treatment was delivered on the basis of a person's resources rather than need. All around the country, extraordinary examples of personal sacrifice are being witnessed in an emergency response, says The Independent in an editorial. But this sense of national crisis is still conspicuously absent in some political quarters. The writer says at some point when the darkness passes, those politicians still thinking of taking a backward step and opting out of government can expect to be asked, "What did you do to help?"
John S. Doyle, thank you, John. And perhaps just to say that at a time when we need reliable information more than ever, do please try to support our newspaper industry. If you find it difficult to buy a physical newspaper in these times, remember that most now have excellent online services to which you can subscribe and in the process help to ensure that they can continue to publish. As people with second homes are urged not to travel to them this weekend to help contain the spread of COVID-19, a leading consultant in infectious diseases is warning that people who are homeless or living in poverty are more likely to contract the infection. Professor Cliona Ní Chealaigh, consultant in infectious diseases at St James's Hospital in Dublin, says poverty may increase people's risk of becoming very sick with the virus. Professor Ní Chealaigh is part of a team in St James's and Trinity College Dublin gathering information information on the progress of the infection. We can talk to her now. A very good morning to you, and thanks for talking to us this morning, Professor Lee Professor Lee Callig.
Good morning.
I suppose one would expect intuitively that homelessness and poverty would be risk factors in contracting any infection, but there is a wealth of evidence, is there not, to back this up?
Absolutely. And I think it's for two reasons. So firstly, that people living in homelessness or living in poverty and overcrowded accommodation are more likely to come into contact with the virus. It's harder for them to self-isolate. And secondly, we think that when people are living in the stress of being poor, particularly like that experienced by homeless people or Roma, that their immune systems are already activated. So they're much more likely when they get coronavirus, we think, to develop more severe disease. There's been phenomenal work in protecting the homeless people in Dublin, and I think we haven't seen the outbreak of coronavirus in the homeless community that we expected. People have been cocooned, they've been protected. It's just amazing. But we're very concerned about the Roma community, in which there are a lot of people living in very close quarters.
And for those who do contract the disease, their risk of becoming seriously ill is that much greater, is that right?
We think it may be. So certainly their risk of becoming much more ill with other infections that we've seen in the past is definitely much higher. We don't know yet with coronavirus, it's so new, and we're looking to look at that research. So it's really important when countries are looking at the statistics of who is getting sick with coronavirus, who is dying from coronavirus, to look at socioeconomic variables, to look at social determinants of health, like people's poverty, like their living conditions. Because if we don't have that data, we can't make sensible policies to reduce the risk in those groups.
Another pattern that's become, I think, fairly clear, and it's around the world in practically most countries where the infection has got a hold, is that men are dying at twice the rate of women. Now, do we understand why that's the case?
No, we have some hints. So the immune system, people who become sick with coronavirus, it's really almost that their immune system has gone into overdrive rather than a difference in the virus per se between people who get very sick and don't. And we know that men's immune system actually works quite differently to women's. So we know that women respond better to the flu vaccine, for example. Women's cells are better at controlling viral infection. And we think that that may be part of the reason why men are getting sicker. And again, lots of research starting already in Trinity and in Ireland to look at this important question.
So it's not necessarily then down to lifestyle, which is often given as an explanation. Perhaps men, taking less care of themselves, maybe more inclined to drink or smoke.
That is certainly a possibility as well. But actually, even if you look in animal models, like in mice or rats, where they can't drink or smoke, women, male mice and female mice respond differently to infection. So there's something about your biological sex that affects your responses to infection.
Can I talk to you about the progress of the infection here? We're hearing from the public health experts that they believe the curve is being flattened, to use that phrase, too early to say yet whether it's been flattened sufficiently to allow our health services to cope. But we've got to keep the measures in place to ensure that everything's done to try and limit the spread of the disease. What do you make in relation to the evidence that's coming forward about the progress of the infection here?
So I absolutely agree. I was on a call yesterday with all the infectious diseases consultants from across Ireland, and one after the other, as each person reported from their hospital, they were saying that they hadn't seen the surge they expected, that the measures are working, and it's just a fantastic position to be in. I think we had been very scared that we would be completely overwhelmed, and that hasn't happened yet, but the social distancing and all the measures need to continue. We don't have a vaccine, we don't have a treatment for the infection, all we have is keeping people apart from each other. It's a bit like putting food colouring. If you put it into a bath, you'll have a huge pool of water that's all coloured with the food colouring. Whereas if you have the water in lots of separate drinking glasses, that food colouring will be limited to that particular glass. Much smaller number of cases that we can manage. So keep going, Ireland.
All right. Our health correspondent Fergal Bowers was reporting earlier that internal HSE documents show that your own hospital, St James, is a very large, of course, acute hospital in Dublin, has the second largest number of cases of COVID patients. I think something in excess of 90, 95. Is that right? How are you coping?
We do. So it's absolutely phenomenal. You couldn't have believed that it would happen, but the hospital has just changed how it works. The staff have changed how they work. We have a huge increase in the number of ICU beds if we need them, and we're able to cope. It's just phenomenal.
Well, we wish you and all your colleagues every success in the days and weeks ahead, and appreciate you taking time to talk to us this morning. Professor Cliona Ní Chealaigh from St James's Hospital, bringing the time here on Morning Ireland to 21 minutes past 8.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson remains seriously ill this morning after being admitted to the intensive care unit of a London hospital. Mr Johnson had been diagnosed with the coronavirus 10 days ago and was taken to hospital on Sunday night, suffering from persistent symptoms of the disease, including a cough and a high temperature. Speculation about the severity of his illness had intensified after the Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab said he hadn't spoken to him in 2 days. Last night, the Taoiseach said the British Prime Minister was in his thoughts and that he wished him a speedy recovery. A short time ago, the Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove explained how decisions will be made in Mr Johnson's absence.
We meet collectively every morning at around 9:15. Normally it's the Prime Minister who chairs, but yesterday and today it will be Dominic Raab who chairs a meeting in which ministers are brought together and officials and also the government's chief medical officer and chief scientific advisor. And then we review the work that needs to go on in order to support the NHS, in order to keep public services going, in order to keep our economy in a strong position. Well, so far we've proceeded completely by consensus, and we do so in a team way, members of the Cabinet, following the scientific advice and the medical advice that we receive. The decision-making process, of course, is that the Cabinet is the supreme decision-making body.
And that was Michael Gove speaking to the BBC this morning. Joining us now on the line is Dr. Andrew Blick, who's the director of the Centre for British Politics and Government at King's College London. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a really unusual situation. Not only is the Prime Minister very unwell, but he's had to hand over power at a time of national crisis.
Yes, indeed. I mean, this kind of thing doesn't come along very often. And it's complicated a bit further in the UK in that we don't really have specific arrangements for how to handle this kind of instance where the Prime Minister is incapacitated, is unavailable. In perhaps in other systems, there might be a specific deputy Prime Minister or Vice President or equivalent. We don't have that. We sometimes have people who are called Deputy Prime Minister, but exactly what that role is can vary greatly, and there's no actual requirement to have one. So yes, it is an unusual circumstance that we don't have a clear, prearranged way of dealing with.
Right, as you say, officially there isn't a Deputy Prime Minister. So what then is Dominic Raab's role? Because we're told that he's now in charge.
Yeah, well, my understanding is he's taking over as necessary. So he's not become the Prime Minister. He's not acting Prime Minister, and we don't have such a thing as acting Prime Minister. I mean, historically, it's not that unusual to have someone else chairing cabinet meetings. I mean, during the Second World War, for instance, when Winston Churchill was away on diplomatic matters, Clement Attlee, the Deputy Prime Minister from the Labour Party in his coalition government, often chaired cabinet meetings. So this can go on, and there's nothing constitutionally particularly extraordinary about that. But I suppose a bigger question is, yes, cabinet can function collectively, and we do have a principle of collective government, but ultimately there is a reason there is a Prime Minister, and there may be decisions that need to get taken, or somebody may need to take a lead, and then the question arises, who is the person who does that?
Like many, many countries, including our own, Britain had already been reeling from the impact of the virus. Are serious decisions likely to be taken in Mr Johnson's absence?
They're going to need to be. I mean, you know, decisions will have to be made, and they'll have to be made somehow. Now, as Michael Gove was saying, so far they've been able to proceed by consensus and following the advice. But if some kind of decision point comes up further down the line, it may not. But let's face it, none of us knows what is coming, what the data might start telling us about countries who are further down the line with the infection than us, etc., etc. At some point, decisions may need to be taken, and it may be that a consensus isn't as easy to reach over them. It may be that somebody needs to come forward. Now, that's where I suppose the job of the Prime Minister comes in, that decisions are taken collectively, but the Prime Minister can sometimes set the agenda or push things in a particular direction. Now, who's going to do that if that time comes? We don't know yet. With a bit of luck, maybe the Prime Minister will be back in action by that point and able to fill that role.
I see that Michael Gove has also been saying this morning that, that the direct quote is, no one is talking in terms of a national government. And yet, despite the fact that the Conservatives have such a massive majority, there has been talk in recent days of a unity government. Why so?
Well, I suppose that there's a tradition in the UK, although often we don't have coalition governments, partly because of our electoral system. We have had them, after all, we had one from 2010 to 2015. Now, in times of extreme national emergency, most obviously the two world wars, but also the economic slump in 1931, in those situations, coalition governments have been put together. And if we look at the instance of the Second World War, the most recent case of a national emergency government as opposed to the coalition of 2010, the Conservatives had a big majority in Parliament, bigger than the one they've got now. So mathematically, they didn't need a coalition. However, they decided that politically, and to get the kind of social consensus that was needed around the difficult measures that needed to be taken, they needed to put together a coalition government, and that's what they did. So maybe no one in the government's talking about it, but people are talking about it. People like me are talking about it and thinking about it. It doesn't mean it's going to happen. And we should also bear in mind that there's been a shift in the main opposition party over the last few days, and they've got, you know, a different kind of leadership that is perhaps a lot more centrist than the previous one, which you could argue is more suited to going into some kind of coalition anyway.
Dr. Andrew Blick, thank you for joining us this morning. It's 8:27.
Australian Cardinal George Pell has been freed from jail after the country's highest court overturned his conviction for child sex abuse. The former Vatican treasurer, who's 78, was the most senior Roman Catholic churchman ever jailed for such crimes. In 2018, a jury found him guilty of abusing two boys, but the High Court quashed that verdict and ordered his immediate release from prison, where he'd been serving a six-year jail sentence. Let's talk to BBC Australia correspondent Phil Mercer. A very good morning to you, Phil, and thanks for taking our call this morning. This was the second appeal by Cardinal Pell. His conviction was upheld by the Court of Appeal in Victoria. On what basis now has the Australian High Court decided to overturn the conviction?
George Pell was convicted, as you say, in late 2018. The trial judge said that George Pell had committed a brazen and forcible sexual attack on two choir boys when he was the Archbishop of Melbourne in 1996. Now, George Pell's lawyers had always argued that the case against him was flawed because they believe it relied on what they said was the uncorroborated evidence of one of those surviving choir boys. And this case has gone all the way to the highest court in the land. This is a unanimous decision. And basically what we have here is that the full bench of the High Court has said that there was a reasonable doubt that these alleged offences could have taken place in a busy cathedral almost 25 years ago. So essentially what the High Court has done has swept away that jury decision and has also swept away that decision by Victoria's Court of Appeal last year.
And he has now or will be released from prison. Has he had anything to say?
He did release a statement. He said that he holds no ill will towards his accuser. He said that he has consistently maintained his innocence while suffering from a serious injustice. Cardinal George Pell left Barwon Prison, which is on the outskirts of the city of Geelong in the state of Victoria, a couple of hours ago, and this does bring to an end a five-year legal saga that took allegations of child sexual abuse right to the heart of the Vatican, given that once upon a time Cardinal Pell was a senior advisor to Pope Francis. Now the challenge for George Pell is to repair and restore his reputation.
And has there been any reaction, Phil, from his accuser or their families?
Not yet. So we did hear in the media here that this young man, who was the sole complainant, the sole witness in this case, saying that he won't be making an immediate comment. He is considering making one, we understand, in the coming weeks and months. Victims and victims' advocates from other cases here in Australia have told us that they are bitterly disappointed by the ruling. The father of one of the choir boys who died from a drug overdose a few years ago has said that his faith in Australian justice has evaporated. So this is a case that not only divides the Catholic community here in Australia, it will divide the broader Catholic family right around the world.
for now, Phil Mercer in Australia. Thank you very much indeed for that.
Stena Line will furlough 600 employees and make 150 redundant across Ireland and the UK. In a statement, the firm said it was forced to take tough decisions to ensure that their supply lines of essential goods are protected. Japan is set to declare a state of emergency and will finalise a $1 trillion stimulus plan to cushion the impact of the pandemic there. More than 100 global organisations are calling for debt payments of developing countries to be dropped this year. The group says resources must be directed towards the needs of populations and not diverted to lenders. Cinema operator Cineworld said today that all of its 787 cinemas across 10 countries have been shut due to the coronavirus pandemic. Let's take a look at the currencies this morning. €1 buys 88.2 pence sterling and $1 8.6 cents.
There's a little bit of sports news this morning, but there's also a cracker of a memory. Joining us is Darren Frehill. Morning to you, Darren.
Good morning, Rachel. There is indeed. Let's start with the news. It's big news. More accusations aimed at FIFA. Fresh claims. Officials were paid bribes to vote for Russia and Qatar as World Cup hosts. The details of the allegations emerged last night from the US Department of Justice. Chief sports reporter for The Times is Martin Ziegler.
You might think you've heard this before, but this is the first time it has been stated in a US Justice Department indictment. What it says is that Jack Warner was paid $5 million through various shell companies to vote for Russia, and that three South Americans unknown sums of money to vote for Qatar for the 2022 World Cup. Billions and billions of pounds has been spent getting Qatar prepared for this World Cup. There will be massive legal implications and a legal fight if they try to do anything to strip the tournament from the Qataris. So I think FIFA will probably take what they think would be a pragmatic approach and think this was all done under a previous regime. Things have changed now and it's perhaps too late to change what took place then.
Now, one other piece of football news. Liverpool have decided to reverse their decision to place some non-playing staff on the government's furlough scheme. They had been heavily criticised for their original decision. Now it's time for our daily trip down memory lane and our sporting moments series. The 1956 All-Ireland hurling final between Wexford and Cork, considered to be one of the finest games of hurling ever seen. Wexford came out on top, but it was a member of the losing team that was carried off the field shoulder high at the end. Donal O'Grady, RTÉ analyst, former Cork manager, has been reflecting on this incredible moment.
Remember the time when a great star did shine, whose likes we had not seen before.
Yes, it's a goal for Cork and it's scored by Christy Ring.
From there, Ring has it now on his stick. He sends it across the goal mouth, right out of the goal, and it's a goal for Cork.
Now it comes into Christy Ring, and Christy tussling with Billy Record, and Jim English comes in, robs both again, sends it way up.
Cork followers looking for that touch of magic from the maestro. Christy Ring has gone in full forward now.
Sends it across, and it's set of Christy Ring, 21 yards out. He sends his shot, and it's a goal! It's a goal!
Red Christy Ring.
Anytime I was practicing hurling and striking the ball against the wall, I always pretended to be Christy Ring, accompanied by Micheál O'Hare's commentary. I was bursting through and scoring as he had done.
Hello everybody and welcome. Welcome wherever you may be. Welcome to join us here in Croke Park, Dublin on this All-Ireland Hurling Final Day.
Wexford dominated the first half of the 56 final and were going very, very well. Now Cork fought back. And they went ahead briefly in the second half to lead by a point. But Wexford hit back.
And it's a goal! It's a goal! It's a goal! If
you could condense the game into the last few minutes. Ring, in a trademark run as he burst onto a breaking ball, struck a great shot for the corner. And Art Foley made a great save with about 3 minutes left. If Cork had scored, it would have put them a point in front.
Kerry Kelly up another Christy Ring. Ring in front of the goal is going through. He steadies himself, he takes the shot. It's blocked by Art Foley and it's cleared out by Art Foley.
And minutes later, Foley made another good stop and struck the ball down the field and it was transferred into Nicky Record and he buried it.
Out comes Nicky Record, 21 yards out, he takes the shot. He's had the goal.
Ring's chance of winning a ninth All-Ireland medal had gone.
And the referee has blown his whistle, called for the ball. again, the All-Ireland champions of 1956. The All-Ireland champions of 1956 are Wexford. Yes, Wexford have won the title, and, well, Croke Park has gone stark staring mad.
That game was reckoned to be one of the best ever, but it's sometimes it's overshadowed by what happened after the game, when Art Foley, Bobby Rackard and Nick O'Donnell shouldered Ring across the field. Ring was acknowledged as one of the greatest players ever, and maybe the Wexford players recognised that this was his ninth All-Ireland medal chance, and Wexford had beaten them, and they just wanted to show appreciation for the man who had graced the field of play for over 20 years at that stage almost. My father would have known him well. They would have met on occasions, they hurled together with Cork. When they met, I would always hang back as a young lad. I was really in awe of Ring. To me, I realised then what it was like to be in the presence of a guy.
And remember the great Christie Ring.
In the presence of a God, that's saying something, isn't it? More memories tomorrow. Back to you, Brian.
The prison service has introduced a range of measures to prevent an outbreak of COVID-19 in the prisons. Social distancing has been brought in for staff and inmates, gyms and recreation halls have been closed, and deep cleaning systems are in place. 80 inmates who showed symptoms have been isolated, but none has so far tested positive for coronavirus. The Prison Officers Association has welcomed the moves and says prisoners don't want to interact with staff because of fears of outside transmission. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds has been to Cloverhill Prison and first spoke to one of the inmates, Gary, about the new restrictions.
The prisoners have been very positive. They know changes is coming. In prison, we're always used to routine, and daily it's changing. But we understand, like, it's the same for the outside as the inside. So we're adapting well.
Gary is serving a sentence in Cloverhill Prison, but he's also a Red Cross volunteer, encouraging other prisoners to wash their hands and social distance to prevent a COVID-19 outbreak in the prison.
Our biggest fear as prisoners is the officers. We know that the virus is not in the prison, and the only way it's going to get in is from outside. And with the prison officers, like, they've got their own measures that they take to ensure that it doesn't get in. But that would be our biggest worry, that it comes in through an officer or staff, member of staff.
Visits have been cancelled, but alternative phone and email arrangements have been put in place. Gyms and recreation halls have been closed in the Irish prisons. Deep cleaning systems and cocooning are also being implemented. Prison officers Costello and Gavin say these have resulted in major changes to prisoners' lives.
Changes would be to recreation areas where there would have been large groups of prisoners congregating are now not open. They are out in yard time is more than cell time, so they just stopped the mass gatherings.
The staff have really shone through this crisis, if you like, along with the prisoners, with the goodwill of the prisoners. I know that the changes for them are definitely something that was unprecedented at the rate and at the speed that they have come into the jail.
80 inmates have been isolated throughout the country's prisons after showing symptoms of the coronavirus. They're subject to a special feeding regime by prison officers wearing full protection equipment.
Prisoners who are in isolation in Cloverhill, they're given a dry pack included in it. You can see they have their bread, their cereals, sugar, some milk and some jam and butters. They have keep this in their cell. It reduces the time that we have to open cell, and it reduces the time that we put our staff in harm's way.
The Assistant Governor in Cloverhill, David Tracy, also says the preventative measures have led to a reduction in drugs and other contraband coming into the prison.
Because our committals has reduced, the amount of committals coming in, we have seen a slight reduction in drug use in Cloverhill Prison. We're concerned that some drugs might come in through the post. We've had letters that are contaminated with the likes of spice, and this type of drug is an extremely dangerous drug to have in our prisons. So what we have done is introduced this email address for prisoners' family. We've effectively stopped mail coming in from prisoners' family, and we can print off the letters they give them. And that's one avenue that we have addressed to stop the flow of drugs in their prison.
Five inmates and prison staff in the UK have died because of the coronavirus, and the prison service says it's working with staff and inmates to prevent an outbreak here. The Director of Care and Rehabilitation, Fergal Black, says so far they've managed to keep it out of the prisons.
COVID-19 presents an enormous challenge to the prison service,
Prisons by their nature are closed, congregated environments, and they are custodial settings. So for us, we've been working on this for the last number of months. We've been involved in training our staff in preparing for it. But ultimately, our objective has been to block transmission where we can, to prevent the spread of the virus if it enters the prison system, and to detect early.
The Prison Officers Association is also supporting the additional COVID-19 preventative measures. 60 of their members are self-isolating at home. Assistant General Secretary Gabriel Keaveney says they accept that inmates don't want contact with officers or staff because transmission from outside is a risk.
Some prison officers, like the wider community, have contacted COVID-19, and they will actually follow public health advice, deal with that. We have a number of members of staff in isolation as well, and that's proper procedure to follow. You will be aware that our staff, one of the first in the country to have their temperature taken before they went to work, that's to try and keep the virus out of the prison for as long as we possibly can.
We don't want it as much as anyone else, and we know if it does get in, it will spread a lot quicker in a confined area like this than it would possibly outside, you know. So
actually then you feel the prisoners and the staff are working together?
Definitely on this one, yeah, definitely.
And that's Clover Hill prison inmate Gary, ending that report by our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds.
Well, amid the COVID-19 crisis, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are continuing to put together a document setting out how they would work together in government. However, between them, the two are 8 seats short of a Dáil majority, and it's been widely reported that they'll approach smaller parties and independents in the hope of forming a broader coalition. They have ruled out approaching Sinn Féin. At the weekend, as you probably know, Labour got a new leader with Tipperary TD Alan Kelly defeating Éan Ó'Riordán. And Alan Kelly joins us now on the line. Good morning and congratulations.
Good morning, Rachel. Thank you very much.
If and when Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael come calling, will you talk to them?
Obviously, we'll talk to anybody who wants to talk to us. I think in these very difficult times, that is the appropriate thing to do. But I don't believe on this occasion that the Labour Party will be in a position to go into any coalition. Simply put, there are 4 parties who have got larger amounts of seats than us. Any 3 of that combination can form a government, and we certainly believe that it is up to them to do so. The country does need a government, and it needs one, I suppose, in the very near future. But any combination of those 4 parties, any 3 of them, can form a stable government with a majority. And that's where the focus should be. They're the parties who got the most amount of seats. 3 of them got virtually the same amount of seats. And the Green Party got a large mandate of 12 seats. And obviously, climate change is the big agenda item once we get over COVID. And really, it's quite disappointing that it seems that they are not willing to put their shoulders to the wheel and stay on the pitch and get involved in this.
They want something different. The other 2 parties won't talk to Sinn Féin. And the world has changed since the 8th of February. The country is facing unprecedented challenges. Why walk away from those challenges when you can play a part in shaping the country's recovery?
I believe the Labour Party will play a huge part in shaping the country's recovery. I think the world has changed. I think politics has changed. It's amazing that Keynesian economics is back in fashion. I think the way in which Ireland is going to have to come out of this is going to have to embrace a lot of things that the Labour Party stood for over the last number of years in relation to housing, childcare, in relation to a 1-tier health system, in relation to a rent freeze, which I've advocated for many years.
And so why then don't you want to be part of that change?
Well, we stood in the last election and we said if we got a mandate, or if we got a critical mass of seats, we would consider going into government, because unlike many other left-wing parties, we are a party that aspires to being in government. But on that occasion, we actually lost the seat, and there were 4 parties with large amount of seats, who any 3 of which can form a government. And really, that's where it should be. That's where the focus should be, rather, on the Labour Party. We didn't get enough seats. Even if we were to add our 6 seats, there still wouldn't be a majority in government. So that shows the realistic nature of this.
You said during the leadership campaign that you wanted to regenerate the trust the party used to have with the people of Ireland. Why did that trust disappear, do you think?
I think we, I suppose, went through very difficult times. I think our focus needed to be in a different direction. It wasn't always there. I think we have to concentrate now on the social contract with the people. People's real concerns coming out of a crisis like this will be have a home, to ensure that we have a health service, which I believe is fundamentally going to be changed. We have to implement slouch of care. The whole issues relating to education, issues in relation to the pension age, and obviously we've seen massive changes now in government proposition in relation to childcare. So they're the areas which the people who we aspire to represent, people who work, people who want to work, people who go out and do an honest day's pay, honest day's work for an honest day's pay, they're the type of issues that they are concerned about. And they're the type of people we are now going to refocus on into the future. And that is certainly where I am going as leader of the party, along with all my colleagues, of which now there are 11, thanks to the fact that we have five new freshly minted senators elected as well.
We heard earlier the suggestion that you could support the government, say, in a limited form of confidence and supply. Is that something you would consider?
Look, there will be a document, I understand, sent to all parties later on this week or early next week. Once that document is sent to us, we will certainly consider it. We'll consider it in detail. I'll talk to my colleagues and we'll respond to that document. And I look forward to responding to it, but I also look forward to putting forward what the Labour Party's vision for the future of Ireland in a completely changed time. And we will do that quite quickly and we will present that to the public to show that we think differently, that we are different to all the other parties. And once we do that, we will consider how we respond. But I do believe that there does need to be a majority government put in place for a number of years. And that's where I think the other four parties should be concentrating on.
Is there a danger, though, that in opposition you could be absolutely overwhelmed by Sinn Féin, which after all has six times as many TDs? I mean, by comparison, Labour looks small and it also looks very male.
Well, also, you've got to understand that we had four female senators elected, and we do want to have a larger female representation into the future. It's my job to ensure we will not be swamped. We will be different, and I aspire to doing so, to making us very, very relevant, to punching way above our weight into the future. But I also want to say, Rachel, to those who are listening at home or driving or in work, you know, we also need a strong opposition into the future. I think that's critically important because, you know, if we have a majority government, which is going to be coming through this crisis, they're going to be making decisions. Very difficult decisions, I grant you. But there also needs to be a strong opposition and people who have experience to be able to challenge those decisions. Right. Because they're going to be fundamental decisions for the future of the country. Right. And I think that's critically important too.
Alan Kelly, thank you for joining us this morning. 8:56.
Hassan and Hussein Ben Haffa from Cork today celebrate the 10th anniversary of their surgical separation at Great Ormond Street Hospital in London. The boys were separated during a 16-hour operation led by Irish surgeon Dr. Edward Kiley. In total, they've had more than 50 surgeries. So today will be a very special celebration. The boys' mum, Angie, is on the line now. Very good morning to you, Angie, and thanks for talking to us this morning. I suppose great excitement in the Ben Haffa house this morning. What are you planning?
Not a whole lot with lockdown, but we're going to make the most of a very special day. We're going to just make a surprise party for the boys, and we've got balloons and baked cakes last night when they were sleeping, and just going to make the most of a bad situation. And, you know, what I've told their sisters last night is the important thing today is that all six of us are together.
Yeah, and I suppose like every other 10-year-old in the country, they're at home at the moment. How's the homeschooling working out?
I'd say as a teacher, I'm going to be definitely fired. but they're doing good. You know, the four of them have actually quite surprised me. This is day 25 for us. And, you know, due to the boys being more vulnerable, I suppose we had to kind of take precautions early on with them. But schoolwork for the boys is something that they do for maybe around 2 hours every day. But
well, that's pretty good.
Kind of, you know, with all the kids, I suppose, I could see my 12-year-old was kind of getting obsessed with doing schoolwork in kind of first 10 days. And I just kind of told all of them that right now, you know, more so than any schoolwork, that I just kind of would prefer they all did something that's just kind of, you know, better for their mental health, you know, because it's not easy being indoors all the time. And
no, and I mean, their ongoing treatment has been affected, has it, by the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for us, we go to Great Ormond Street a few times a year in London for their treatment, and obviously that's all going to be put on hold. So as a mum, I worry about, you know, them with that, and I wonder when London will get back to normal, because I know Great Ormond Street itself has been hit badly. So, you know, and like last week, we'll say unexpectedly, and with the boys and with their, I suppose, complex medical history, is sometimes, you know, they can get sick suddenly or unexpectedly. And last week, one of Hassan's old wounds opened up and was oozing, and I had to get in touch with their surgeons in Crumlin. And he felt, because of Hassan and, you know, what I suppose he's gone through, that he wanted to see him. And Bumblance were due to bring us up to Crumlin last Friday morning, but it was cancelled then Thursday afternoon. So we're waiting for that to be rescheduled. But, you know, you're kind of nervous as a parent then to go into a hospital.
Of course.
In case you don't come back out, you know, that you're there and, you know, put in isolation. So I've just been dressing his wound myself, and thankfully it's got better. But just scary times, you know, especially if you do have children who can run into difficulties. But, you know, we're just doing our best on a day-to-day basis like every other family.
And today, perhaps just one day, you can put those worries aside and celebrate a fantastic 10th anniversary.
Yeah, we're just going to concentrate on the boys today, you know.
Well, listen, very best wishes to all of you, Angie, and thanks very much indeed for talking to us, if briefly this morning. Appreciated your time, and have a great day. All right. That's Angie Ben-Hafaf. The time just approaching 9 o'clock.